And my thanks to Frederick Buechner for inspiring the sermon this morning. Friday was hard. There was no one who would argue with that. Watching him die was brutal. And everyone went to their homes and to the places they were staying in a state of shock. And because it was the Jewish Sabbath that evening, the meal and the prayers seemed to numb everything. It was familiar. And in some way, the fact that it was ordinary seemed to help them get through it. Saturday morning came, and with the dawn came that sickening memory as they recalled the previous day's events. And you may know the feeling. No, that was not a horrible dream. It's reality. It was all there. It was burned into their memories. The torture, the humiliation, the jeers, the indifference of the soldiers as the life seeped out of him. The hours of waiting for the inevitable death. And then the withdrawal back to the seeming safety of their homes. What do you do on a Saturday after a Friday like that? What do you do when someone you love dies in such a horrible way? When the hope-filled future you saw unfolding had been crushed. Saturday was rather strange. People weren't sure what to say, uncertain how to act with each other, and so a bit of formality helped. They were careful with their words, and they acted deliberately. They didn't want to cause offense or stir up emotions unnecessarily. They tried to keep a lid on things that Saturday. And you know how it is after a funeral, and everyone heads back to the house for platters and casseroles and drinks. There's a politeness, sometimes a stiffness in the conversation. People are trying to remain positive, and some even overcompensate. Perhaps that's related to the third glass of wine, but they start to tell jokes. Perhaps a little louder and more deliberately than they would at another time. But there is laughter, some of it forced, some of it a bit tentative. Some of it surprisingly genuine. I mean, is it okay to laugh after someone you love dies? Is it okay to do normal stuff, to eat and drink and think about someone or something else? Should I feel guilty about that? How do I do this? It's an odd time after a funeral. Eventually, you realize that this is it. This is what life is going to be about. The ordinary stuff of life will go on, but it's just never going to be quite the same. But that was Saturday, and that was the Sabbath. And on Saturday, on the Sabbath, there are limits on the ordinary stuff you could do, so things were still fairly confined, but now it's Sunday. And that was really the day they were dreading, because Sunday is the first day of the week. It was the day you did everything that you would normally do, work and play and family stuff and travel. On the Sabbath, you would reflect on things, but on Sunday, it was back to the ordinary way of being. Would they just start to get on with things? Would they experience closure, as today's expression annoyingly goes? Would things settle down into whatever routine would now look like? I mean, that felt a little bit like betrayal to some. I mean, hey, Jesus was dead. They all knew that, but still, what was it going to be like now? I mean, just a few days ago, the world was their oyster. It seemed like the possibilities were endless. Freedom was at hand. Hopes were high. The movement was large, and then there was death. Now it was Sunday morning. The Sabbath done, a work day. And there were these crazy rumors. Some of the women had gone to the tomb to do some care for the remains, and they'd come back with this quite alarming story of his body being gone. Raised from the dead? Well, come on. We weren't born yesterday. That sort of thing doesn't happen. Crazy rumors began to circulate. It's kind of painful, they thought. And so two of the number thought that getting out of this madness might just be the best thing to do. We learned that one of them was named Cleopas. And some of us have suggested that this is actually a married couple. That if you go to John chapter 19, verse 25, you'll see a reference to there at the cross, Mary and Clopas. We don't know for certain. What we do know is that these two were leaving Jerusalem. Enough already. Time to get away from the city altogether. Perhaps to rest at a relative's, not too far from Jerusalem. A little place close by, Emmaus, a village about 7 miles from the capital. Have you ever been to Emmaus? I haven't either. Its actual location is subject to all sorts of speculation. But I suspect we all have been to Emmaus. We really do know the place. Emmaus is a place where you go to be distracted. It's where you go and what you do to take your mind off things. For me, it's a bike ride or reading a cheesy novel. For you, it might be a quick 9 holes of golf or a long walk or a vigorous run. A trip to the mall to buy a pair of shoes you don't need. A drive to Shemanis. For some, it can even be coming here to church. Emmaus is where you go when you've thrown your hands in the air, when you just need to forget, when you've stumbled into some situation where you've been confronted with the possibility that, yes, life is unfair, and that the best and the brightest will get ground down to nothing. A place where you go when you thought a life that was noble and beautiful has been crushed. Emmaus is where you go when Jesus, the one we loved and trusted and believed in, Emmaus is where you go when he's been tortured to death and has been revealed to have been a complete and utter failure. Nearly 2,000 years after that first Easter, having heard the resurrection story so often to the point where it is actually foundational in our life together, it's often hard for us to fully appreciate how wild and yet how ordinary this story is. It's not dramatic in the same way that Christmas is. I mean, Christmas has angels and heavenly choirs and visiting magi and all that kind of thing. I mean, that's a show. Hence our love of Christmas pageants. And it's something that translates well into spectacle. Of course, Good Friday is stark and brutal and filled with a bruising and disturbing drama. And truth be told, we don't like much looking there. Best we don't dwell too much on that. Let's just nod and move on. And then there's our story this morning. It's not so dramatic, really. It's kind of everyday, ordinary, gentle, commonplace. Two people are walking to the village of Emmaus and a stranger slips in beside them. That must have been surely normal practice in that time and place. That's how you kept safe then. You would travel in numbers. Of course, the question I always wonder about is, why didn't they recognize this stranger, Jesus? I mean, they're his disciples, right? And they may have been with Jesus for years, and yet they don't know who he is. So what's that about? And I don't really know the answer to that question. I've heard all sorts of suggestions. He may have had his hood up and they couldn't fully see his face, or that they had tear-filled eyes and they couldn't properly see him. One venerable commentator has offered that Emmaus was probably west of Jerusalem, and being that it was late in the day when they were walking, they were therefore walking into the sunset, and that meant the sun was in their eyes. None of those reasons I have found especially convincing. And frankly, I'm not really sure what's going on here. But then again, this seems to be a common feature of the resurrection stories. No one seems to recognize Jesus. So maybe we should pay some attention to that. See, what I do know is I have trouble recognizing him too. More often than not, I figure it out after. Not at the time. So this interested and interesting stranger walked with them, and they talked, and they talked about what had happened, and he began to help them connect those confusing events with the scriptures. And then the next thing you know, they're at the village, and the stranger makes to leave, and the two disciples say, "Don't go. Please, stay with us. Come, eat with us." And I'm thinking this stranger must have seemed like really good company. Because even though he's a stranger, they don't want to let him go, and he obliges. As they sat together at the supper table, the stranger took bread and he prayed over it and he broke it, and suddenly they knew it was him. They knew it was Jesus. And as their hearts were filled with what was surely joy but confused joy, "It's the Lord," then he was gone. Just vanished from view. Frederick Buechner puts it this way: they could not make him stay. They could not nail him down. And that is how it always is. We can never nail him down, not even when the nails we use are real ones and the thing we nail him to is the cross. He comes suddenly out of nowhere, like the first clear light of the sun after a thunderstorm. Or maybe like the thunder itself. And maybe we recognize him, and maybe we do not. And our lives are never the same, either because we did not recognize him, or because we did. What staggers me is where he comes to them, where he comes to us. It's not usually as we search for him, but it's usually when we're escaping something. It's in a place where we've gone to get away, where our troubles seem a bit further afield, where that nagging suspicion that none of this life business makes sense, and even the Jesus doesn't make sense, and all that confusion just recedes for a while. But it's just those times that Jesus is likeliest to come, when we're walking away, when we're walking to, when we're about to have a meal, in ordinary times, not in the midst of some dramatic event, or I'm sad to say, during a sermon, as much as I'd like to convince myself otherwise. But it'll be on a walk somewhere. Or when someone passes you the spaghetti. You just have to look at the gospel resurrection appearances, and they're all so ordinary. They're not especially dramatic. Jesus speaks to Mary where? In a garden. Speaks to Peter on a beach. Talks to Thomas in the back room of a house. I mean, these are the kind of places that you and I might likely be. And that seems to be the way it works. It's the way he works. We look for the sacred. We look for the holy, those mystical, numinous moments. And he chooses to find us in the everyday. We thought it was simply a stranger joining us on a journey, a gardener, a dinner with friends. But then we hear a word, and we recognize a voice that sounds like home, even though we're not sure we've ever actually heard that voice before. And suddenly things fall into place, things make sense like they didn't make sense to that particular moment. And we are aware that God is indeed alive. And that a death on Good Friday let loose a love on Easter Sunday. It's amazing that Jesus has come to us. Still, I know that Easter's a challenge for a good many. Honestly, if you want absolute proof that Jesus was indeed raised from the dead in the wee hours of Easter morning, you will probably not find what you are looking for. And for those who have been a part of this fellowship for a few seasons will know, I keep trying to present that story in a way that I hope is a reasoned way. I try to present it in such a manner that we can see the evidence that would lead you to believe in Jesus' resurrection. Lots of us preachers in lots of churches, probably most churches I'd guess, we try to give you a reason to believe in something, but honestly, it's something that appears to contradict reason. And I will keep doing this, like most other preachers, because it's helpful for us to look at the evidence. And there is evidence. But really, in the end, You're going to have to believe without complete, irrefutable proof. And actually, that's the only way it can work. If anyone could prove to you the truth of the resurrection, the absolute truth, then you would have to believe, right? You would actually not have a choice in the matter anymore. And that would be a terrible loss. We would therefore be forced to love a God who, most of all, wants us to choose for Him. And a love that's forced is no longer really love. Authentic love demands freedom. It demands a freedom not to love. As Buechner suggests, love must be prepared to suffer even as Jesus on the cross suffered. And part of that suffering is doubt, even as Jesus on the cross doubted. Still, absence of absolute proof doesn't mean that there aren't witnesses. We heard about two of them in our biblical text today, and there are many more here this morning. People have experienced the presence of the risen Jesus, the one we have met on the way, met at our tables, and even at this table, which of course is His. So friends, I invite you to come to the table today. I know, it's just bread and grape juice. It's nothing special. They're just ordinary, everyday things. In the everyday, exactly where our Lord Jesus most often meets us. Thanks be to God. Amen.